Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. This week we're talking about our May 26th issue, and we have as guests Elliot Holt, whose first novel, You Are One of Them, is reviewed in this week's issue by Maggie Shipstead.
She's a character who spent her life thinking of herself as a footnote in someone else's story, and here she's finally telling her own story.
We'll also have Rick Atkinson in. He is the author of The Guns at Last Light, and he will be here talking to Barry Guin, an editor at the Book Review.
Like most great events in American history, there's more to discover. There's more to read about. People will be reading about World War II, I'm quite confident, 500 years from now.
We will have Julie Bosman with Notes from the Field, and our editor, Paul Sagel, will also talk to my colleague, Greg Coles, about bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
I'm talking to Elliot Holt. She is the author of You Are One of Them. It is her debut novel, and it is reviewed this week by Maggie Shipstead in the Book Review in what could only be called a glowing rave review. So welcome, Elliot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Now, you are calling in from Washington, which is in part the setting of this new novel. Tell us what it's about.
The book is about a friendship between two American girls. And it's narrated by Sarah Zuckerman, who grows up in Washington in the 1980s and has this best friend who lives across the street named Jennifer Jones. Her friend becomes famous as a child peace ambassador because she writes a letter to then-Soviet Premier Yuri Andropov, and the letter gets a response, and she's invited to the USSR on a kind of whirlwind, much-publicized media tour, becomes this international media sensation, and then dies in a plane crash. But early on in the book, the inciting moment is that the narrator receives a mysterious letter from Moscow suggesting that perhaps her friend didn't really die. So she sets out to the former Soviet Union to try to figure out what really happened. So much of it is set in Moscow, and much of it is set in D.C.
Right off, this is based on a true story, of course.
Yes. You know, the events are not, it's not a Romanoklev, but
right.
It's
inspired by...
Yes, Jennifer Jones' character is inspired by Samantha Smith, who was a little American girl from Maine who became famous for writing to Andropov in 1982 and was, in fact, invited to the USSR in the summer of 1983. She and her parents visited Moscow and what was then Leningrad. She went to visit a Soviet pioneer camp. There was a book published about her trip to the Soviet Union, and she was sort of turned into this, you know, child peace ambassador, and was everywhere for a couple of years. She even was cast in a TV show called Lime Street with Robert Wagner. And then she died in a plane crash in 1985, and most people have forgotten about her.
But you didn't.
I didn't. She was a couple of years older than I am, and I didn't know her. But when I was growing up in D.C., I was worried about nuclear war. I think a lot of kids my age and a little bit older were. You know, we watched The Day After, which was that really terrifying film.
Oh, I remember it well.
Yeah, totally terrifying. It's funny, I watched it again when I was doing novel research, and even though the special effects are really dated, it was still terrifying because it's so plausible, you know.
I remember they had a warning about, you know, who should watch this and who should turn the change the channel.
And, you know, it was shown without commercials, and this was sort of pre-cable, so almost everyone saw it, you know. Like, it's hard to imagine now what that would have been like then, you know, for practically the entire nation to have seen the same TV show at the same time, but I think people of a certain age remember very clearly watching that film. So anyway, I was worried about nuclear war. I followed Samantha Smith's tour and story with great interest, and she inspired me when I was a child. And then when I got older, I found myself thinking about her in kind of a different way. I just thought it was interesting the way she had been kind of packaged and sold as this child ambassador, and the way that, you know, things are projected onto children. Children represent innocence, and they, you know, she got kind of used for propaganda.
I'm here. I'm talking to Elliot Holt. She is the author of You Are One of Them. It is her first novel, and it gets a glowing review in this week's issue of the Book Review from Maggie Shipstead, who says, "It is a hugely absorbing first novel from a writer with a fluid, vivid style and a rare knack for balancing the pleasure of entertainment with the deeper gratification of insight." The novel is really a Cold War novel, and Elliot was just talking about how it takes place in Washington in the 80s and in Russia in the 90s. Now, you lived in Washington in the 80s and spent time in Russia yourself, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, I wanted to set it in those two cities because, you know, they were the capitals of the superpowers, and I was playing with the Cold War tension, sort of looking at this very specific friendship, but with the backdrop of Cold War. So it seems really important to me that the book take place in those two superpower capitals. But yes, it helped that I grew up in D.C., so I know the city very well, and I lived in Moscow for 2 years, from 1997 to 1999. The first time I visited Moscow was in 1993, though, so I was there again in 96. So I have some familiarity with the city that was in the mid-90s. It's changed so much since then that it's sort of hard to keep up with how fast Moscow's changed. But
now, Elliot, you won the 2001 Pushcart Prize, of course, for short fiction, and a Penn Emerging Writers Award. You were a runner-up for that. You've been working on this book a long time, right?
Yeah, I had the idea for, well, first I wrote a short story with this premise when I was still in graduate school at Brooklyn College. The original story was very satirical. It was kind of a rant by the narrator who'd been left behind by her famous friend. And I think I was just sort of interested in looking at the idea of how fame would sort of change a friendship, and, you know, with this Cold War backdrop. And then I realized it was kind of one note. So I realized maybe a year later, I think maybe even it was 2007 or 2008 before I realized this really wanted to be a novel. And I resisted that for a while because I really like writing short fiction, and I just didn't think I'm a pretty concise writer. I wasn't sure I could write a novel. I spent a couple of years writing a lot of pages that I just threw away, sort of trying to figure out what the shape of the book was going to be, and then I finally kind of broke through. Then, yes, finally, by the end of 2011, it was a book.
So the book is You Are One of Them. I'm talking to Elliot Holt. In her review, Maggie Shipstead says, "Holt's descriptions of Moscow in the mid-1990s are fascinating, slyly funny and full of melancholy details. A frozen drunk covered with icicles on a bench, a never-flown space shuttle on display in Gorky Park." Were these memories from your own experience time in Moscow?
Yes. The last time I was in Moscow was 2001, and I have not been back since because I didn't want to go back until I was done with the book, because I really didn't want contemporary Moscow to get in the way of my very clear memories of Moscow in the 90s, which was, you know, a city that was kind of not broken exactly, but it was, you know, everything was very run down and the infrastructure was kind of falling apart, and it was, you know, making this very rapid transition into a capitalist society. There was a kind of noir quality to the place, and I did not want contemporary Moscow to get in the way of that.
And that noir aspect is conducive to the story, which is, in large part, takes on this question of, you know, is the friend really dead?
Right. And I think I decided very early on that this book had to be first person because I think it's important for the reader to question how reliable Sarah's version of events is, and because she's a character who spent her life thinking of herself as a footnote in someone else's story, and here she's finally telling her own story, letting go of her obsession, this idea of kind of being martyred, or being a martyr. And so I think because she's feels like she's been betrayed in her past, she's susceptible to a certain degree of kind of paranoia, and certain kind of suspicious mindset that was not uncommon. Certainly when I lived in Russia, so many of my Russian friends were conspiracy theorists, and I don't blame them given that their government lied to them for so long about so many things. So I really did meet tons of people who said to me, "Oh, Americans didn't land on the moon. You don't really
right.
you don't really think that happened, did you?" And I was kind of shocked. I moved to Moscow, it never occurred to me that we didn't land on the moon, you know.
Well,
wait, what?
We will leave the mystery as to whether it's really a conspiracy or whether Jennifer is dead or not to readers to discover. Elliot, thanks so much for being with us. That was Elliot Holt, author of You Are One of Them, reviewed by Maggie Shipstead in the May 26th issue of the Book Review.
Thanks so much.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power by John Meacham. That's Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
We've got Julie Bosman here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So what is going on this week?
So this week we had what I called the literary version of the reality show Storage Wars, which, if you're not familiar with it, is where people buy the contents sight unseen of storage units and then discover a lot of random and usually worthless things. But in this case, a woman in Texas last year bought the contents of a storage unit and discovered in it a manuscript by Pearl S. Buck, the Nobel laureate and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. And this was believed to be her only unpublished manuscript.
Now, Buck wrote, of course, not only The Good Earth, but which won the Pulitzer, right?
Yes.
But also, she was very prolific, wasn't she?
She was incredibly prolific. Some people would say too prolific. She is often saddled with the same criticism that Joyce Carol Oates and a lot of other people are, which is that they just write too much. But Pearl Buck really kept writing until the end of her life. Her husband was her publisher for a while, so she was just churning out book after book after book, and he was just publishing them immediately.
It's not like a J.D. Salinger or, you know, manuscript has been found here.
No, not exactly. This isn't going to change literary history, but it is interesting in that the story of how this manuscript ended up in Texas is completely unknown. When she died in 1973, the estate was in some disarray, and a lot of people were stealing things from her, you know, walking off with her works, with her papers. And so we don't really know what else is out there. But one manuscript was found, and it's going to be published in October.
And who's publishing that?
The publisher is Open Road Integrated Media, which is the mostly digital publisher founded by Jane Friedman, of course, the former chief executive of HarperCollins.
And are they bringing out a print edition, or is this going to be something that's exclusively electronic?
They are going to bring out a paperback edition, but not a hardcover edition. So it'll come out simultaneously in ebook and paperback in October. And Open Road, I should add, is the only publisher of Pearl Buck's backlist. I believe they have almost 30 of her novels currently for sale digitally, but not in paper.
All right. Well, leaving seventh graders trembling nationwide. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Pamela.
Hello, I'm Barry Gouinet, an editor at the New York Times Book Review, and I'm talking today to Rick Atkinson, who's just completed the third volume in a magnificent trilogy, the Liberation Trilogy, about the United States' role in World War II. The first volume, called An Army at Dawn, described the U.S. activity in North Africa. The second volume, The Day of Battle, was about the campaign in Sicily and Italy. And now we have The Guns at Last Light, which is about the final months of the war from the D-Day invasion to the very end of the war. Rick, I'd like to start by saying that this trilogy took you more than 15 years to complete, and I was wondering why you undertook it in the first place.
Yeah, I wondered that myself at times, Barry. I was born and bred in the Army. My father was an Army officer. I was born in Munich, so I grew up in the Army of the 1950s and 60s, where World War II was very much part of the landscape. It was part of the culture, and many World War II veterans, like my father. So I had a native interest in it. And then in the 1990s, I was Washington Post bureau chief in Berlin, and I was there for that endless succession of 50th anniversary commemorations of the invasion of Normandy and the Battle of the Bulge and so on. And that kind of rekindled that native interest. And I began thinking of it as one narrative that doesn't begin on the beaches at Normandy, as many Americans think, but in fact, it begins in North Africa in late 1942 with the American and British invasion there. And then it moves across the Mediterranean to Sicily and then to southern Italy before we get to Normandy. And as I thought more about it, I saw it in these terms, and I saw it, I recognized that it is a bottomless story. Like most great events in American history, there's more to discover. There's more to read about. People will be reading about World War II, I'm quite confident, 500 years from now. So that was the origin of it.
Did you think it would take you this long? And did you think it would take you three volumes to tell the story?
It was conceived as a trilogy right from the get-go. It was not conceived as a book that would take as long as it did, so often happens. I had hoped that it would be 3 years per volume, and I began full-time in 99. The first book was published in 2002, so that was 3 years. And then I went to Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division, then commanded by a young major general named Dave Petraeus, and I wrote a little book about that. So that threw me off schedule and gave me an excuse for being late with the second book, which was published in 2007. And then this last book has taken me certainly longer. I figured there would be an order of magnitude increase in the archive and the material between North Africa and Italy, tenfold increase, which was about right. And I figured it would be another order of magnitude increase for Western Europe. Well, I think it was two orders of magnitude. It was a hundredfold, because the war gets so big and there's so much material. The archival trove is so rich and deep. So it definitely took me longer than I thought it would.
And have your views of the war changed from the beginning of your researches to the present, or have they remained fairly consistent?
You know, I think they've intensified in some ways. I've written six books altogether. They're all about war. I consider each of them to be an anti-war book in some fundamental sense. And I think that this sixth and final book confirms my view that it is an unmitigated catastrophe. You can't spend your professional life living with young men dying young without viewing it as a tragedy of the first order. And certainly my views about World War II run along those lines, even as I recognize the necessity of it and the righteousness of it. The characters that I've lived with now for 14 years or so, I feel have become my companions over time. And they're people that you've heard of, like Eisenhower and George Patton and Omar Bradley and Bernard Montgomery, but others who have been lost to history and are now obscure. And I believe that a narrative historian's first task is to bring back the dead, and that's part of my ambition here.
When you speak of these characters being your companions, it makes me think of the technique that you use through these books, and it's really something quite remarkable. I'd like to read just the opening sentences of the prologue, which will give our listeners a sense of what you're doing. It begins, "A killing frost struck England in the middle of May 1944, stunting the plum trees and the berry crops. Stranger still was a persistent drought. Hotels posted admonitions above their bathtubs, quote, 'The 8th Army crossed the desert on a pint of day, 3 inches only, please,' close quote." Our reviewer has described this as almost a pointillist technique, almost like George Seurat putting together a large painting from very minute pieces of information. And that seems to be what you do. And quite frankly, it's a gripping technique. How on earth were you able to accumulate all of that detail, that vividness that gives your book such richness?
Yeah, thank you, Barry. I never thought of myself as George Seurat, but I like that. I'm a big admirer of his. Well, I think first and foremost, you have to be an archive rat at heart, which I have discovered that I am. The archive is enormous. The U.S. Army records for World War II alone weigh 17,000 tons. That's more paper than we can possibly begin to imagine. And if you are an archive rat, and if you are willing to do the time, months cumulatively, then years, you can find these extraordinary brushstrokes of detail that are necessary, I think, to the kind of technique that you're talking about. And so my ambition is not only to bring back the dead, but to bring an epic to life. And to do that, I think you need to be very specific. You need to empower the reader's imagination. That's always my ambition, to let the reader do the work. I'm a nonfiction writer. I'm a historian. I must hew as closely as possible to the standards and the appropriate standards of academic rigor. And yet, I also believe that that's not inconsistent with allowing the reader's imagination to draw that scene for you.
How do you see your volumes fitting into the enormous corpus on World War II? We have some great historians out there like Max Hastings, for instance. How does your work fit into that larger collection of work?
There are some great historians. I think Amazon.com, I believe, lists something on the order of 60,000 hardcover titles for World War II. So that's quite daunting. I recognize that others have trod this ground before, and trying to be original is a task, and I recognize that right from the get-go. My feeling is that part of it is voice and narrative coherence, but also I believe that because that archive is so enormous, I can find many things virtually on every page that even the most assiduous reader of World War II history has not read before. I also think that the narrative scheme here, it's really one story. We're asking the reader to buy it three times in three different volumes, but it's really one story. And when you see it that way, when you understand it, beginning on the eve of the invasion of North Africa in November 1942, even though those volumes can be read independently and understood coherently in and of themselves, I think that that is a unique approach to the war in Europe in particular.
Well, it's really a wonderful accomplishment, and I just want to close with one simple question for you. What comes next?
That's a good question. I'm going to leave World War II, Barry. 14 or 15 years is enough of my life on that subject. I considered doing the same thing for the Pacific and decided some time ago not to do that. It doesn't capture my imagination in quite the same way. I'm very European oriented in my life, born in Europe and lived there as an adult. I will find another war. That's what I do. I write about war, another American war of some sort. I'm mucking around now trying to decide precisely which one.
Well, good luck with your future projects.
Thanks so much, Barry.
Hi, this is Farrell Sagal, a preview editor at the New York Times Book Review. I'm joined by Greg Coles, another editor with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Farrell.
So what's on the list?
Well, on the combined list this week, on the nonfiction side of things, there are five new titles. Starting down at number 14, Bill O'Reilly. Maybe it's wrong to call this book a new title. It's called Keep It Pithy. And what it does, it basically, he's calling it a highlight reel of previous writings, kind of the best of his previous books. And he's going back and quoting lines and then revisiting them, updating them according to the latest news and weighing in on whether he thinks he was right or wrong. Generally, he thinks he was right. At number 9, Jessica Buchanan is on the list with a book called Impossible Odds. I don't know if you remember her name. She was a teacher, an American teacher, who went to Kenya and then to Somalia, where she was kidnapped Somalia. And she was married to a Swedish man who wrote this book with her, as well as a ghostwriter. She was rescued by Navy SEALs Team 6 in a kind of a daring nighttime rescue, went in, killed 9 of the captors, and brought her out alive. Mm-hmm. And so this book is going back and looking at there. It's another Navy SEAL book on the list. Mm-hmm. Not a surprise these days. Then at number 8, Jimmy Connors, the great 1970s tennis star and outsized personality, who really kind of disappeared from the scene after he retired from tennis, has come back now with a memoir called The Outsider.
Okay.
That's new on the combined list at number 8. At number 7, not a new book. This book came out in 2011. It's called The $80 Champion by Elizabeth Letts. Last week on the podcast, I talked about the phenomenon of old books that were making their debut on the combined list, and I wasn't sure why that was. And several listeners wrote in to say a lot of it has to do with pricing. Amazon especially will have daily deals in certain categories. There's a romance daily deal or a fiction daily deal, and where they lower the prices of their ebooks for that day only. And so suddenly last week, Ann Patchett turned up on the fiction list for a book that came out in 1997. It was because Amazon had discounted it down to $2.99. I'm not sure if that's what's going on with the Elizabeth Letts book, The $80 Champion. It may in fact be selling because the Preakness was last week. And this is a book about a show jumping horse called Snowman, who was a big kind of show jumping champion during the Cold War. At number 1, actually both the fiction and nonfiction lists this week, the top book on the list is a debut book. On the nonfiction side, it is Rick Atkinson's The Guns at Last Light. It completes his Liberation trilogy, which is about World War II, about the Allied victory in World War II. The first two books of the series looked at the Allied sweep through North Africa and through Italy. This one looks at D-Day and Western Europe and takes you right through from D-Day all the way to the German surrender 11 months later.
And what about fiction?
On the fiction side of things, there is a 2008 title making its debut on the list at number 14. It's by Lisa Jackson. It's called Left to Die. Then at number 11, H.M. Ward, who is a romance writer and a suspense writer, has part of her Arrangement serial, The Arrangement 7.
Okay.
These are very short, they're serials, so you know, maybe 100 pages long, and they always end on a cliffhanger.
And these are romance novels.
They are, yes. I'll read you the description of, this is when Avery learns Sean's dark secret, everything changes.
Got it.
And at number 3, a paranormal romance called Eyes Wide Open by Rain Miller is new on the list. And at number 1, no surprise to anyone on earth, in heaven, in hell, in purgatory, Dan Brown's Inferno. And I can't tell you how it pains me to say Dan Brown's Inferno.
So he's been catching a little heat about his writing style.
Oh,
am
he
right?
Has. It's great. I mean, the reviews for this have been terrible and great. It's my favorite.
Some memorable reviews.
My favorite comes from the Daily Telegraph in England. Jake Carriage wrote, "As a stylist, Brown gets better and better. Where once he was abysmal, he is now just very poor." And Carriage actually calls this Brown's worst book. And for a sad, even noble reason, his ambition here wildly exceeds his ability.
So has Dan Brown responded to the criticism?
He has, Parle. And it's kind of sweet, actually. He's hurt by the criticism. He told BBC recently, "I wish everybody loved what I do, of course. Of course it's hurtful. I've learned that universal acceptance and appreciation is just an unrealistic goal. If a reviewer is beating me up, I just say, oh well, my writing is not to his or her taste."
And what's the story?
The story of the book?
Yeah,
well, Robert
the
Langdon, this symbologist who...
He's back.
Yes, he's back from the Da Vinci Code. He wakes up in a hospital with, like, total amnesia, and... the story basically involves a bioterrorist, kind of a mad scientist type, on a boat off the coast of Italy, plotting to wipe out half of humanity to combat overpopulation, which he thinks is going to bring us down. To save us, he needs to kill us, or half of us. And the clues scattered throughout the book, as there always are in Dan Brown, this time all relate back to Dante's Inferno and the circles of hell that he talks about.
Well, Inferno has been like a sort of evergreen topic, no? Within a number of books?
It's interesting that Inferno or the Divine Comedy, Inferno is the first part of, have been kind of coming back lately. Mary Jo Bang, an American poet, did her own translation of the Inferno last year. Mm-hmm. Then Clive James, a British poet, did his translation of the Divine Comedy this year. Mm-hmm. Clive James talked to USA Today when the Dan Brown book came out to say, you know, maybe this will help my sales. Yeah. And anyone who thinks there's not enough rhyming in the Dan Brown can turn to my version of it. Uh-huh. And Penguin Books released their 2006 translation of the Inferno with a cover line saying, read the original to find out the secrets to Dan Brown's Inferno. So people are really trying to cash in to get Dante to sell in the wake of Dan Brown.
And will we see these books on the bestseller list?
Dante? We won't. The news survey department at the Times, which tracks, which comes up with our bestseller lists, makes a general rule of not tracking bestsellers, which is also, by the way, why you won't find The Great Gatsby on the bestseller list, even with all of the attention it's been getting with Baz Luhrmann's movie.
Yeah.
I talked to the director of Scribner Publicity. Scribner is The Great Gatsby's publisher. And he said, you know, if we did track that, there's no question it would be at the top of the trade paperback list right now. In a normal year, it always sells well. In a normal year, they might sell 500,000 copies or more of The Great Gatsby. But this year, with all the buzz around the movie, they have already sold more than 1 million copies in just the first 5 months of the year.
Okay, thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pearl.
Thank you so much for joining us. There's more online at www.nytimes.com/books. And for the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.